From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is the free speech issue of our time. We cannot allow the FCC to implement a pay-to-play system that silences our voices and amplifies that of big corporate interests. We have come to a crossroads.
As the FCC votes to allow broadband providers to charge companies for faster delivery of their content, we'll speak with Senator Al Franken of Minnesota on net neutrality and media consolidation. Then Credit Suisse becomes the largest bank to plead guilty to criminal charges in the United States in 20 years.
Credit Suisse and its subsidiaries engaged in an extensive and a wide-ranging conspiracy to help U.S. taxpayers evade taxes. The bank actively helped its account holders to deceive the IRS by concealing assets and income in illegal, undeclared bank accounts.
The bank's stock price rose after the settlement, and the chair of the bank's board says Credit Suisse is as white as snow. While no senior Credit Suisse executives have gone to jail, Occupy Wall Street protester Cecily McMillan has been sentenced to 90 days in prison. We'll look at who goes to jail and who doesn't. Then the data pirates of the Caribbean. Did you know the NSA is working with the Drug Enforcement Agency to record every cell phone call in the Bahamas? And we remember civil rights pioneer Vincent Harding. He helped write Dr. Martin Luther King's speech against the war in Vietnam. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thailand's military has imposed martial law after months of anti-government protests. The protesters have blocked elections and called for the ouster of a caretaker government installed after Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat was removed by a court earlier this month. Soldiers have blocked off streets in the capital, Bangkok, and at least 10 TV stations have been ordered to shut down. The army's denied its efforts constitute a coup. The Obama administration's announced charges against five members of the Chinese military for economic espionage against U.S. companies, including Westinghouse, Alcoa and U.S. Steel. Attorney General Eric Holder accused the officers of stealing trade secrets to benefit state-owned companies.
All nations are engaged in intelligence gathering. What I think distinguishes this case is that we have a state-sponsored entity, state-sponsored individuals, using intelligence tools to gain commercial advantage. And that is what makes this case different.
China has denounced the indictment and summoned U.S. Ambassador Max Baucus. The United States has denied engaging in economic espionage, despite reports from Glenn Greenwald and others about its efforts to spy on economic targets, from global conferences to the Brazilian oil firm Petrobras. The charges came as a new report by The Intercept reveals the United States is secretly recording virtually every cell phone call in the Bahamas. We'll speak with the report's co-author, Ryan Devereaux, later in the broadcast. London cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri has been convicted of terrorism charges by a New York jury. He was accused of aiding kidnappers in Yemen and trying to set up a militant training camp in Oregon, although his attorneys argued the case relied largely on beliefs expressed in his sermons. He could face life in prison. A federal judge has denied a request to stay the execution of a Missouri prisoner who suffers from a rare medical condition which he fears could cause an excruciating death. The judge also rejected Russell Bucklew's request to have his execution filmed as evidence of cruel and unusual punishment. Bucklew's lawyers have appealed. His execution, set for 12:01 a.m. Wednesday, would be the first since last month's botched killing in Oklahoma. In both states, the source of the lethal drugs has been kept secret. Credit Suisse has pleaded guilty to a criminal charge and agreed to pay $2.6 billion for its role in helping U.S. clients avoid taxes by concealing assets in undeclared bank accounts. It's the largest bank to plead guilty to a criminal charge in the United States in 20 years. We'll have more on the plea deal later in the broadcast. Jill Abramson has delivered the commencement address at Wake Forest University in North Carolina just days after she was fired as executive editor of The New York Times. Abramson was the first woman to hold the post and had reportedly complained about making less than her male predecessors. In her address, she discussed how she co-authored a book about Anita Hill, who testified about sexual harassment by Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas before an all-white, all-male Senate panel in 1991.
The senators portrayed her as being, as one of her detractors so delicately put it, a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. She turned that potential humiliation into a great career teaching at Brandeis University and writing books that tell truth to power. Anita was one of the many people who wrote me last week to say they are proud of me. Those messages are so appreciated.
In another commencement address at Reed College in Oregon, Speaker Igor Vamos announced the school's decision to join a growing movement by divesting from fossil fuels.
I was very pleased to learn that the Board of Trustees of Reed College has just now decided to divest the school's $500 million endowment. Is what's most interesting. They're pulling the money from those industries and they're reinvesting it in community-owned renewable energy projects.
The announcement received a standing ovation. The only catch is that Reed College has not actually divested from fossil fuels. The speaker, Reed alum Igor Vamos, also known as Mike Bonanno, is a member of the culture jamming activist group The Yes Men, who is carrying out his latest political prank. The ruse involved a fake website and press release, which fooled at least one news outlet. In a real statement, Reed College said its trustees are reviewing the student call for divestment. Occupy Wall Street activist Cecily McMillan has been sentenced to 90 days in jail and 5 years probation for elbowing a police officer during her arrest at a protest. McMillan has claimed she struck out instinctively when her breast was grabbed from behind. 9 of 12 jurors had written to the judge asking him not to sentence her to any prison time. We'll have more on the case later in the broadcast. In two victories for marriage equality, a federal judge has ordered Utah to recognize more than 1,000 unions that occurred before a stay was issued by the Supreme Court, while another judge has struck down Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage. Couples began tying the knot in Oregon almost immediately after the ruling. The historian, author and civil rights activist Vincent Harding has died at the age of 82. He was a friend and speechwriter for Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and co-wrote King's famous anti-war address, Beyond Vietnam. Speaking on Democracy Now! In 2008, Vincent Harding talked about King's vision.
By the last years of his life, he was saying that America had to deal with three, what he called, triple evils: the evil of racism, the evil of materialism, and the evils of militarism. And he saw those three very much connected to each other.
That was Vincent Harding. He died yesterday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Aaron Maté. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, we begin with major developments that could shape the nation's media landscape for years to come. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission advanced a proposal that critics say threatens net neutrality, the concept of a free and open internet. The new rules could allow internet fast lanes, where companies pay providers for faster access to consumers. That sparked a wave of protests from opponents who say the rules hand too much power to the major companies who can afford to shell out, consolidating their control at the expense of smaller competitors and consumers' monthly bills. Similar concerns have been raised about a merger deal struck over the weekend. The telecom giant AT&T has agreed to buy satellite television operator DirecTV in a nearly $50 billion deal. The move comes just months after Comcast announced plans to merge with Time Warner Cable.
We turn now to one of the leading voices on Capitol Hill challenging media consolidation, Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota. He serves on the Antitrust, Competition, Policy and Consumer Rights Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Franken joins us now from Capitol Hill. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Senator Franken. Your response to the latest decision by the FCC?
I was very unhappy with that vote. It was Tom Wheeler, the chair of the FCC, had— It kind of been leaked out a couple weeks prior to this that he was open to a fast lane, meaning that the antithesis of net neutrality. Net neutrality has been the architecture of the internet from the very beginning. And what it means is it treats all digital content, all content that comes across the internet to you, the consumer, through the internet service providers, it's all treated the same. It's all treated equally or neutrally. And that has led to all this innovation that we've had over all these years on the internet. And what Chairman Wheeler is talking about is allowing a fast lane, and it would be deep-pocketed corporations that would be able to buy this. And so information would come to viewers from big corporations faster, or consumers, and this really would hurt innovation. It has freedom of speech issues. Let me give you just an example of why this all information traveling the same has led to innovation. Years ago, there was a thing called Google Video. It wasn't very good. And the guys who created YouTube did it in over a pizzeria in San Mateo, California. It's a better product, and because it was allowed to travel at the same speed as the Google product, people got to see it, and they sampled it, and they liked it better, and so we have YouTube. And in the same way, we've had all this explosion of innovation over the internet because of net neutrality. In the same way, this threatens democracy, something I know you're interested in, and because right now your show travels as fast as Fox News, travels as fast as the New York Times, someone blogging right now, not liking what I'm saying, could do this instantaneously, can do that and get it up as fast as any other piece of information. If you have a fast lane for corporate news and corporate information and corporate content, that threatens our very democracy.
Well, Senator Franken, SEC Chair Tom Wheeler has denied claims he is abandoning net neutrality.
Those who oppose the idea of net neutrality might feel like a celebration is in order. Reports that we're gutting the open internet are incorrect. I'm here to say to you, wait a minute, put away the party hats. The open internet rules will be tough, will be enforceable, and with the concurrence of my colleagues, will be in effect with dispatch.
That's FCC Chair Tom Wheeler speaking last month at Cable Show 2014, the cable industry's largest trade and trade show. Of course, he himself was a former cable industry lobbyist. Senator Franken, now, according to Wheeler's proposal, these content deals could be done if they're, quote, commercially reasonable. What do you understand that to mean, and do you trust the FCC's vow that they're going to review these cases individually?
Well, one, I don't know what that means, and so that's a problem. And two, I don't trust the FCC's ability to do this. The FCC could do something very simple. It can just categorize the internet as a telecommunications service. We give it the authority to enforce net neutrality, and that would be as simple as that, and they could just do that. There was a lot of pushback a few weeks over the last several weeks when it was first leaked that he's talking about a fast lane. I don't see how you can do a fast lane and not undermine the whole concept of net neutrality. I just don't see it. There's going to be a comment period now, so maybe we will learn more about what he means. That content, by the way, as I was listening, it did seem to travel very slowly.
Senator Franken, Michael Powell is now head of the NCTA, the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, which is the cable industry's largest lobbying group. He, of course, his target is net neutrality, opposing net neutrality. But Tom Wheeler, who is President Obama's nominee, was the head of the major—this largest cable lobby. What was expected, and do you think President Obama should now fire Tom Wheeler? He's the one who appointed him.
Well, I believe that the president did make a pledge before he became president to keep net neutrality in place. And I really do think he should honor that. So, you know, and Powell was the one who categorized in 2002 when he was FCC chair, he categorized the internet as an information service. Again, all we need to do is just change it to a telecommunications service, and it gives the FCC every authority it needs to protect net neutrality. But as you can see, this sort of revolving door is kind of disturbing.
They've switched places, but they seem to be doing the same job. So how, yeah. In the Senate, who are your allies, and how does something like this get done to reclassify it as a common carrier, as a utility?
Well, during the comment period, you know, he did open up that to discussion in this new preliminary rule. And I think that's good. And again, I think it was kind of pushback from what he got starting several weeks ago when it kind of leaked out that he was talking about a fast lane. He has the authority to do it. The FCC has the authority to just say this is a telecommunications service, which it is. It's a common carrier, which gives it the authority to enforce net neutrality, and that's what he should be doing.
Senator Franken, the amount of money that are going into these mega deals between Comcast, Time Warner, AT&T, DirecTV is staggering. $45 billion, Time Warner, Comcast, $48 billion, AT&T, DirecTV. Are you concerned here that we're creating this business model where basically companies are spending all their money buying each other up instead of investing on infrastructure that could actually bring the U.S. in line with the rest of the world in delivering quality internet?
Yes, that's occurred to me. You know, during the Comcast, latest Comcast hearing where they're talking about purchasing, acquiring Time Warner Cable, they said that this deal would spur a lot of what you were talking about, investment and technologies. And so the first thing out of the gate, they say it started a dogfight. The first thing out of the gate is just another big telecommunications giant buying, you know, a big a delivery system, the second largest pay TV system that we have. So this is really disturbing, is just the whole concentration of media. This will be in the hands of fewer and fewer companies. This is something I warned about in 2010 when we had the Comcast NBC Universal deal before us, and I opposed that as well. And I said, this is what's going to happen. And this is all unfolding in a very disturbing way.
Do you think your colleagues in the Senate are afraid to take these mergers on? Because, I mean, these are the media entities that cover them. And what actually—how does it affect the consumer if AT&T merges with DirecTV, Time Warner merges with Comcast?
It has a bad effect on consumers. I think consumers, as we've seen this concentration in media, has paid for it. You've seen this past year the cost to consumers, like, triple the rate of inflation over the last 20 years, more than double the rate at the rate of inflation. So, and Comcast told its investors that they will leverage their position to make more money, and they have not said this won't increase the rate that consumers are paying for their services, and so this is not good for consumers. As for my colleagues, I think that there's a lot of skepticism about both of these deals. We know more about exactly what Comcast, Time Warner is. We had a hearing. We heard a lot of skepticism. I'm the only one who's just come out against the Comcast Time Warner cable acquisition. I want to look more at what AT&T is. I'm skeptical. I want to look at it a lot more.
Mike Rogers, the House Intelligence Committee chair, said he's leaving the House to become a radio talk show host. You were a radio talk show host, Senator Franken, and you wrote for Saturday Night Live. What has this transition been like for you going to the Senate? And what advice would you give to Intelligence Chair Mike Rogers?
I would say listen to my show. And... and try to do that, and to have fun with it, and do the best job he can. That would then good luck. I think we're pretty different where we, how we see things. But for me, this has been a great transition. This is a job where I can get things done. Sometimes it's frustrating, but. It's very satisfying when you have wins, and sometimes they're bigger than others. And I'm not, people ask me some version of, is this being a senator as much fun as working on Saturday Night Live? And no, it isn't, but this is the best job I've ever had.
Now, how does your background in media influence clearly the strongest position fighting for net neutrality in the Senate right now and opposing these mega media deals?
I think it has given me a better view on Comcast NBC Universal, that acquisition. I had some insight into that and some of the history of authorities given to networks, FinCEN, financial syndication rules being changed in 89, 90, and how that led to independent producers being kind of their production being diminished, and how sometimes the networks don't say, or the owners of the networks don't say that they're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to act in their own interests. And so it gave me a better perspective, I think, than other people on the committee. I'm on Judiciary, and obviously we look at antitrust. Amy Klobuchar is the chair of the antitrust subcommittee. She's a former prosecutor, very good, very knowledgeable lawyer. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a lawyer, but this experience in this business, I think, has helped me.
And Senator Franken, back to the FCC's new rules. Now, of course, they're not set in stone. Now we have the comment period for 4 months. How important will it be for citizens to speak out during these 120 days?
I think it's very important. I think that Chairman Wheeler reacted to all the pushback from the leak of his preliminary proposal or his proposal. And I think it's very important that we use skeptics and opponents of this ruling express themselves, use this comment period. I think it's very, very important.
Finally, while the U.S. was the one that developed the internet, it now ranks among below scores of countries for internet speed and access. The World Economic Forum ranked the U.S. 35th of 148 countries in internet bandwidth. Other studies rank it anywhere from 14th to 31st in the average connection speed. Why are we so slow in the United States?
I think part of it is that we didn't categorize it as telecommunications. I think that would have helped. And I've been, my state of Minnesota, we have a lot of rural areas in Minnesota that are underserved. And actually, in the last budget process, I teamed with Deb Fisher, a Republican from Nebraska, to spur more investment in rural broadband. This is something we need to do to keep economically competitive. This is the kind of infrastructure that, when you look at what builds prosperity, you look at education, research and development, and infrastructure, and this is the rural electrification of the 21st century.
Senator Franken, thanks so much for being with us. Democrat of Minnesota, opposes the AT&T and DirecTV deal, is one of the leading congressional voices to challenge corporate consolidation in the U.S. media. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the largest settlement with a bank, criminal settlement in U.S. history, it's with Credit Suisse, yet its chair still says Credit Suisse is white as snow. Stay with us. Depeche Mode, everything counts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Just a little correction. Credit Suisse is the largest bank to plead guilty to a criminal charge. This is Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
Well, yes, indeed. European banking giant Credit Suisse has pleaded guilty to a criminal charge for helping American clients avoid paying taxes by concealing assets in illegal, undeclared bank accounts. Credit Suisse becomes the largest bank to plead guilty to a criminal charge in 20 years. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the plea on Monday.
In the course of our painstaking, years-long investigation, the department discovered that Credit Suisse and its subsidiaries engaged in an extensive and a wide-ranging conspiracy to help U.S. taxpayers evade taxes. The bank actively helped its account holders to deceive the IRS by concealing assets and income in illegal, undeclared bank accounts. These secret offshore accounts were held in the names of sham entities and foundations. And this conspiracy spanned decades.
As part of the plea deal, Credit Suisse will pay about $2.6 billion in penalties and hire an independent monitor. But the bank will not be required to turn over the names of the Americans who used the bank to evade taxes.
Under the deal, no senior Credit Suisse executives will face jail time, and the bank will be allowed to continue operating in the United States. According to the New York Times, the Securities and Exchange Commission voted last week to grant Credit Suisse a temporary exemption from a federal law that requires a bank to hand over its investment advisor license in the event of a guilty plea. To talk more about the case, we're joined by James Henry, former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, now a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network and senior fellow at the Vail Columbia Center on Sustainable International Investment. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you assess this settlement?
Well, I think it's a big missed opportunity. You know, this investigation has been going on for 4 years. You know, this is one of several Swiss banks that are under investigation. 14 were all lined up. And the reason the Swiss stock market, and in particular Credit Suisse, is soaring this morning is because they are delighted with this deal. They're yodeling through the Alps over the light touch that Eric Holder, you know, who has a tradition of this. In 2000, he was the assistant attorney general who signed off on the Mark Rich pardon. And in this case, you know, 2000—
Mark Rich was—
Was the, major Swiss-based trader who was violating U.S. regulations and tax evading all over the place at that point.
So he was the man that President Clinton pardoned.
President Clinton pardoned at that point. He got enormous backlash for that. In this case, we have the second-largest Swiss bank, a bank with 45,000 employees and 1.26 trillion Swiss franc client assets under management. You know, getting away with essentially a fine that amounts to 3 months of their net earnings. No senior executives, as you mentioned, are going to jail. Bradley Dugan, the CEO, is expected to stay on, in fact, and he said in front of his shareholders this week that this will have a very slight impact on Credit Suisse's performance. You know, I think we've missed the opportunity to really send a message here, because the way they structured this plea bargain was to rule out any impact on Credit Suisse's license to operate in the United States. It was the only impact that a criminal prosecution could have had. And I think going forward, the banks in Switzerland will be looking for new ways, new inventive ways of serving Americans.
In terms of withholding the names of the clients who hid their money, the argument from Credit Suisse was that, of course, Swiss law prevents them from doing that. It protects their privacy. Does that stand here in the U.S.? And how big of a win for Credit Suisse was that, in that they got to keep the names of those they helped?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, this is worse than the UBS settlement in 2009, in which some names were given up. And so, you know, this is part of a negotiation. The Justice Department can say, look, you know, no deal. You want your license, you give us information on these Americans who are evading.
I'd like to go to a brief clip from the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations meeting in February. Senator Carl Levin questioned Credit Suisse CEO Brady Dugan about the U.S. citizens who'd been evading taxes.
So we're interested in collecting taxes as well that are owed, that have been evaded. And we need the cooperation of the banks in order to do that. But if the banks won't cooperate, citing Swiss secrecy laws, then we simply have got to use our own domestic laws to force cooperation from the banks. Now, you cite Swiss secrecy laws, and I gather you said, I think, Mr. Dugan, that you don't agree with those laws. Is that correct?
Well, I think our position is very clear, which is we are ready to provide any information that we can legally provide. But I think that, as you point out, the issue that we have is we have two different legal jurisdictions, and therefore, you know, for us to break the law in one jurisdiction in order to provide that information is difficult for us to do. But I think the most important thing from our point of view, we can't necessarily influence these discussions between governments and how they proceed. We are ready to provide any information that we can provide legally.
That's Credit Suisse CEO Brady Dugan testifying before the Senate. James Henry, does the administration have a reason for not wanting these names released as well?
Well, that's hard to say. I've talked to people of the administration,
Whether it's the Obama administration,
yeah,
Bush administration, right?
This cuts across parties. This is really an issue on, I guess you'd call it the Bankster Party, agrees, which is basically they have been very soft on punishing corporate crime in general with respect to banks. And Wall Street banks have been serial violators here. We're talking about, in this case, a Swiss bank that, you know, has been doing this kind of activity for decades. Dugan has been at the bank for 25 years, and throughout that period, they've been operating this kind of money laundering for wealthy tax evaders.
Explain what they did. What was the crime that they committed that they're paying for?
You know, for example, they had a department that set up so that wealthy Americans who came to Geneva Airport had a special office. And, you know, something like 10,000 clients of this bank went through that office and, you know, were able to bring in their transactions, check on their accounts in utter privacy. There's no name on the door, you know, they would send bankers undercover to Art Basel, big Miami art convention every year, and meet clients. They sponsored a lot of these art
Swiss
shows.
So Swiss bankers would come in on tourist visas.
Exactly. And they would be basically recruiting wealthy Americans to take their money secretly to Switzerland, put it there essentially tax-free, no reporting to the IRS. So for wealthy Americans who were able to play that game, it was worth quite a bit. Of course, for the rest of us, the ordinary taxpayers who are, you know, withheld against and don't have the option of going to Switzerland, you know, will never meet a Swiss banker and in the United States. This is just another case of where we're transferring tax burdens to the poor and the middle class who don't have any choice but to pay up. So basic question about the rule of law here, about justice being essentially for sale. You mentioned the Obama administration. Eric Holder used to be an attorney at Covington & Burling after he left the Clinton administration. He was handling UBS as a client. The chief IRS legal counsel, Mr. Wilkins, used to be a registered representative for the Swiss Banking Association in Washington when he was a partner at Wilmer Hale. You have the U.S. Treasury Secretary was in charge of Citibank's global private banking department when he was at Citibank in 2006. So this administration is literally—and, you know, one of the key golfing partners of the president of the United States, Robert Wolf, used to run UBS America. He was a big fundraiser for Obama in 2008. So this administration is permeated with people who are basically very sympathetic to Wall Street and to Swiss interests as well. So,
well, you mentioned Attorney General Eric Holder, who's been sort of the architect of the strategy that forcing banks into guilty pleas should be done in a way that doesn't harm the economy. And he used his weekly message earlier this month to clarify the Department of Justice position on prosecuting financial fraud.
There is no such thing as too big to jail. Some have used that phrase to describe the theory that certain financial institutions, even if they engage in criminal misconduct, should be considered immune from prosecution due to their sheer size and their influence on the economy. That view is mistaken, and it is a view that has been rejected by the Department of Justice. To be clear, no individual or company, no matter how large or how profitable, is above the law.
Testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee a year ago, Holder had in fact suggested that some banks are too big to jail. Do you agree with his denial now that that strategy is not in effect?
There's no evidence in the settlement that there's anyone going to jail at the senior levels of Credit Suisse. Everyone is in place. The chairman of Credit Suisse today said that they were white as snow. And that both he and Dugan would remain on. You know, so that's just rhetoric. And I think the problem is we have a lot of rhetoric. Major media are basically playing this up as a major settlement, first criminal prosecution. The BBC yesterday said that this is the end of bank secrecy in Switzerland. This is just ludicrous. If you look below the covers, this is a big missed opportunity. It's, you know, we're not going to have this kind of opportunity again very soon.
Is it a crime for someone to secret away their finances in a Swiss bank?
If you're a U.S. citizen, you have to report your income to worldwide income to Treasury and the state tax authorities as well.
What happened to those names that were released by UBS of wealthy Americans who were hiding their money away in Swiss bank accounts? And what should happen?
Well, there've been a lot of settlements with those folks, private settlements that you know, the IRS did go after quite a few of them. One of the whistleblowers in that case got. And Bradley Birkenfeld got a large settlement as a reward for his activity. But one of the issues here is that in Credit Suisse, we didn't have whistleblowers. And this Justice Department has really failed to produce or to take advantage of Swiss whistleblowers who were available to them. And so we don't have any names from whistleblowers like we had in the UBS case. And in this case, they are invoking Swiss secrecy.
Well, while no Credit Suisse executives will be heading to jail for facilitating widespread tax evasion, a New York City judge has sentenced an Occupy Wall Street protester to 3 months in jail and 5 years of probation. Cecily McMillan was arrested in March 2012 as protesters tried to reoccupy Zuccotti Park. She was convicted of deliberately striking an officer with her elbow. McMillan says she swung her arm instinctively after being grabbed in the right breast from behind. McMillan faced up to 7 years in prison. Her case sparked a national outcry and pleas for leniency, even from a majority of the jurors who initially found her guilty. Many of her supporters say the trial should have been about the police assaulting her, not vice versa.
After Monday's sentencing, supporters of McMillan spoke outside the courthouse. The speakers included Lucy Parks of the Justice for Cecily support team and McMillan's surrogate mother, L. Nairobi Moss, but first, her lawyer, Martin Stoller.
History will say that there was over-policing of the Occupy Wall Street movement and that Cecily McMillan became an object of prosecution. I don't see any reason why Cecily would be prosecuted for a felony except to send the message out that says, do not get yourself involved in protests, do not get yourself involved in demonstrations, otherwise we're going to severely deal with you if we have a reason to do so. The fact that 90% of all the Occupy arrests were dismissed tells me that the police department made such bad arrests that not even the DA's office could go forward and prosecute them.
How did this case compare with you? You said you've done this a long time. This case any different or
It's extraordinarily different. It is a felony for assaulting a police officer. There are half a dozen other charges that were brought for people from Occupy that are accused of assaulting a police officer, but they were dropped. They were lowered. People were given ACDs, people were given repleaters, and people took disorderly conduct.
Will there be an appeal?
There will be an appeal. The notice of appeal was filed this morning. An appeal will be conducted to try to get a new trial and remove the stain of a felony conviction from Cecily's record.
Yeah. We have a statement from the Justice for Cecily support team that I'm gonna read for y'all. So today, Cecily McMillan was sentenced to 90 days in prison for being sexually assaulted by a police officer at a protest and then responding to that violence by defending herself. We all know that Cecily did not receive a fair trial and this case will be fought in the Court of Appeals. The sentencing of Cecily McMillan has elicited an array of deeply felt responses from a broad range of individuals and communities, and it has also created a moment to think about what solidarity means. For many of us who consider ourselves to be a part of the Occupy movement, there's first and foremost a simple and deep sadness for a member of our community who has endured a painful and demeaning physical and sexual assault and now has had her freedom taken away from her. Cecily's mama, Nairobi Moss, has a few words that she wants to say with us.
My child has never been a martyr. What she is hope. What she is a testament to the generations that you can speak out and that your voice is not in vain. I just got a text from Cecily's father that says she's been vocal since she came out of the womb, and she really has. But without you guys and without your support, this trial, this case, what has happened here would not have gone so far or reached so wide. And we definitely want to thank you for all of your support.
Cecily McMillan, again, has been sentenced to 90 days in jail. To talk more about this case, James Henry is still with us, former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, lawyer, economist, senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. And also joining us, Ryan Devereaux, staff reporter at The Intercept. He also covered the Occupy Wall Street movement as a Democracy Now! Fellow and reporter for The Guardian, and was there the night Cecily McMillan was arrested. First to James Henry, you know, this contrast of Credit Suisse, the settlement that was reached with Credit Suisse, and who goes to jail, an Occupy protester.
Well, I think this is just one of many such contrasts. We have the Obama Justice Department, to me, is a mystery. I mean, they go after whistleblowers like, you know, no one has ever done before. They go after Aaron Schwartz, who was a hacker up in Boston, a very talented guy.
You know, who ultimately committed suicide.
I mean, I have—it's hard for me, especially when I look at the history of the behavior of the financial institutions and the lack of integrity across the board, not only Credit Suisse, but the top 22 banks have been involved in, you know, as Credit Suisse was, in LIBOR rigging, currency rigging, the credit frauds of the mortgage collapse. Money laundering, just rampant cases across the board. And they're basically getting away with murder here. I think this is a disparity in sentencing. You know, it's like they get time off for bad behavior.
Ryan Devereaux, you were there the night Cecily McMillan was arrested. If you could set the scene for us, what was that protest like?
Yeah, so it was 6 months after the initial occupation, and
Throughout the day, it was a celebratory mood, and into the evening, occupiers had sort of strung up some tents across the park with some wire. The police didn't like this. They moved in. There was a call to disperse. 100, 150 or so occupiers had sort of gathered in the middle of the park, and the police just came in row after row after row. And I, you know, as Amy said, I'd covered Occupy basically every day, every sort of action that happened. And that night stands out to me as probably the most violent night that I witnessed, including the evacuation, the initial evacuation of the park.
Who was committing the violence?
The police department, the NYPD. They came in, and I literally saw protesters dragged by their hair. Heard people screaming in pain. It was an extremely violent night, and I ended up seeing Cecily in handcuffs near the front of the park by the bus where they were loading up people that they were arresting, sort of, for lack of a better word, flopping around on the sidewalk, and it was truly disturbing while people screamed for medical attention for
her. She said she had a seizure. Your final thoughts on this, what we take away from that night?
I think that it will be unfortunate if the only thing that people remember about that night is this one incident and this one conviction, because that night was emblematic of the way that the NYPD treated this movement, treated protesters, and treated journalists for months on end. It was excessively violent.
We're going to leave it there. Ryan, we'd like you to stay because you have a remarkable piece in The Intercept, Data Pirates of the Caribbean. The NSA is recording every cell phone call in the Bahamas. And James Henry, thanks so much for being with us, former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, now with the Tax Justice Network. This is Democracy Now! Back in a moment.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Alone. My home, yeah, yeah, love. Singing freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm
Freedom, sung by Richie Havens at Woodstock in 1969. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matic.
Well, a new report reveals the National Security Agency is recording every single phone call made in the Bahamas, even though the U.S. has said the Caribbean nation poses little to no threat to Americans. The story is based on documents leaked by Edward Snowden that described a classified program called SomalGet, which was put in place by the NSA without the knowledge or consent of the Bahamian government. Instead, the website The Intercept reports the agency seems to have obtained access through the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. One NSA document says the overt purpose for recording calls in the Bahamas is, quote, for legitimate commercial service. But the same document adds, quote, our covert mission is the provision of SIGINT, or signals intelligence.
Documents released by Snowden show the system is part of a broader program known as MYSTIC, which also monitors the telephone communications in Mexico, the Philippines, Kenya, as well as one other country, which The Intercept says it's not naming in response to specific credible concerns that doing so could lead to increased violence. For more, we're joined by the story's lead author, Ryan Devereaux, a staff reporter with The Intercept. His new story with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras is Data Pirates of the Caribbean. The NSA is recording every cell phone call in the Bahamas. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ryan. So talk about your findings. Summarize them step by step.
Right. So as you mentioned, our story details an NSA program called Mystic, first detailed in a Washington Post story. Mystic was developed by the NSA in 2009. It's variously sponsored through a number of sub-programs, which are controlled by the NSA's Commercial Solutions Center. This is the NSA wing that works with the NSA's secret corporate partners. As you know, the NSA wouldn't be able to function if it wasn't for the corporate partners that it relies on to gain access to communications networks in various countries. It's also co-sponsored by the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, and the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA. So, as you mentioned, this program has gained access in Mexico, Kenya, the Philippines, the Bahamas, and one other country that the Intercept is not naming at this time.
No, why is the government telling you not to name it?
This is a conversation that we had for weeks as we sort of reported this story, trying to determine whether or not it was responsible to name this country. The NSA, the government, didn't want us to name any of these countries. We named four of them. With this final country, we came to the conclusion that naming it would very likely increase risk for people on the ground. And as you know, Amy, this is one of those decisions that, as a journalist, covering national security stories is very difficult to make, and we don't take it lightly at all. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to potential for people being killed, we take that very seriously, unfortunately. That's about as much as I can say about that country. We did, however, name a number of other countries that the government doesn't want us to name, including the Bahamas. Now, it's important in understanding this story to understand the difference between Mystic and Somalgut. Mystic is the Commercial Solutions Center program that provides legitimate commercial services to foreign governments while collecting covertly on the side and in the background signals intelligence on those countries. So this program targets the mobile communications networks of these countries. Basically, what the NSA does is sneak in there through its commercial provider and pull out signals intelligence. So the second program, Somalgut, which is active in the Bahamas, is even more robust. What Somalgut does is attacks the mobile communications network and sucks up the actual content of calls on that line. So in the Bahamas, the NSA is able to pick up every single phone call on the mobile communications network and essentially house those calls for up to 30 days, allowing U.S. analysts to go back and retrieve the communications of people who they weren't targeting. The idea is that they're able to listen in on conversations that they weren't looking for in the first place. In the case of the Bahamas, where the most realistic reason why the NSA might have an interest in things going on in the Bahamas is drug issues, smuggling issues.
Isn't it also a key tax haven?
It's a key tax haven. But these documents do not lay out any interest on the part of the NSA in taking down money launderers. Though the NSA may very well be interested in that, this specific program, according to the documents, targets drug traffickers and human traffickers. It does not target the major financial institutions and Western banks that underpin the black market for drug trafficking and human trafficking. It is about revealing specific traffickers. The documents talk about uncovering a plot to ship nearly 90 pounds of marijuana to the United States. This isn't about taking down the sort of power brokers in the drug trade. So what the NSA has been able to do here in the Bahamas is basically collect everything that's there, be able to basically resurrect conversations at will. And they're using this as a test bed, basically. This is the exact phrase that the NSA uses in the documents. The Bahamas is being used as a test bed for implementation of these systems elsewhere.
So that's key. So it's not particularly the case that they're going after somebody in the Bahamas. The Bahamas just could be a test run for their operations worldwide. But let's go into this. You basically exposed this Trojan horse where the DEA asked the Bahamas for a wiretap, say, on a drug dealer. The DEA then takes that wiretap and hands over access to Bahamian telecommunications to the NSA, who then taps the entire country. Is that legal? And could that then jeopardize the existing and legitimate law enforcement actions that are in place with the DEA?
So this is one of the most important elements of this story, I think, for people to understand. On the legal issue, the NSA is operating in a pretty gray area here. The Bahamas has been working in the last several years to sort of establish statutes surrounding communications intercepts, but it's all sort of still in the works. a lot of other countries around the world have existing standards and statutes regarding the interception of communications. Now, that's not to say this is legal under Bahamian law, right? It doesn't seem to be. It seems to be illegal. But still, the Bahamas is a bit behind some other countries in terms of rigorous standards. With respect to U.S. law, under Executive Order 12333, which the NSA and the CIA uses to conduct surveillance abroad, there's a lot that U.S. analysts and agents can do. So this could very well, under Executive Order 333, be legal for the NSA to be doing. Mm-hmm. Now, the more important question about what this means for U.S. cooperation with foreign law enforcement agencies and the DEA's operations abroad, this is central and key, because the idea of lawful intercept, the very thing that allows the NSA access to these networks, is premised on the idea that you have a specific person that you're targeting who is under suspicion of criminal activity. A judge signs a warrant. You know, this is judicially approved, and you go after one person. You don't tap an entire country in hopes of finding something that's interesting.
And the role of private contractors? We just have 30 seconds.
The role of private contractors, as I mentioned here, is essential. The NSA wouldn't be able to do what it does without the help of the private sector. And that's exactly how they got in here in the Bahamas and how they get in other countries around the world.
And what most surprised you?
What most surprised me is that it's the Bahamas. This is a Carnival cruise destination. This isn't a terrorist hotbed.
Ryan Devereaux, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ryan Devereaux is a staff reporter with The Intercept. His news story with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras is Data Pirates of the Caribbean. The NSA is recording every cell phone call in the Bahamas. We'll link to The Intercept at democracynow.org. As we end today's show, remembering Vincent Harding, the historian, author and civil rights activist. He died Monday at the age of 82. He was a friend and speechwriter for Dr. Martin Luther King, and he wrote the draft for Dr. King's famous anti-war address, Beyond Vietnam. Speaking on Democracy Now! In 2008, Vincent Harding talked about the speech.
There was a great deal of struggle within the community around Martin about the speech, even more than about the speech, about what position King should take in relationship to what our country was doing in Vietnam and what our country seemed intending to do all over the world. But it's important to recognize that King saw these issues not simply as what we call foreign policy issues. King was most deeply a pastor. And King saw these issues in terms of what they were doing to the poorest, weakest, most vulnerable people in this country, as well as what they were doing to the poor of other countries, particularly, in this case, Vietnam. So King did not see himself as separating his attention from this country and turning it overseas. King saw the natural connection between what was happening to the poor in the USA, why young men and women were rising up in anger, frustration, desperation, saw that action as deeply related to the attention that the country was paying to the devastation it was doing in Vietnam. And so King was actually trying to bring the country together to sense the relationship between its sickness at home to the sickness of its policy overseas.
Vincent Harding, the historian, author, professor, and civil rights activist, died Monday at the age of 82 in Colorado. He was a friend and a speechwriter for Dr. Martin Luther King, and he wrote the draft for Dr. King's famous anti-war address that he gave at Riverside Church April 4th, 1967. Vince Harding was also professor emeritus of religion and social transformation at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver. We will link to all our broadcasts of interviews with Dr. Vince Harding. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Nicole Sorrent, Nirmeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.